Love Sport Radio. On digital radio, online, mobile and smart speaker. This is the James Gray Show with the Lords Taverners.
You're listening to a podcast edition of The James Gray Show. You can listen to me live every weekday from 1:30 p.m. on Love Sport Radio, on DAB Digital, online or on your Alexa smart speaker. And if you're listening to the podcast, do leave us a rating and a review on iTunes, Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Love Sport.
Back from a brief jaunt to the frozen north, I can tell you St Andrews is still cold, it's still windy and it still rains a lot. But it's still a lovely place. So if you do fancy a couple of days away, I'm not working for the tourist board, but it's a great place to go. I can highly recommend it. England, meanwhile, struggling with some injuries. A hamstring tear for Jason Roy and those back spasms for Owen Morgan. Let's speak to Martin Bicknell, who's on the line now. Martin, this is always going to be the challenge of a World Cup. It's a long, old tournament and you're going to have injuries. Do you think England have got the squad depth to cope with it?
We'd hope so. I mean, James Vince is obviously sitting on the sidelines waiting for a go, so he'll be the obvious one to slip into the team.
What do you make of Vince as a one-day player? We've seen a lot of him in the Tests. And look, we've seen a lot more of James Vince than a lot of people have expected over the last couple of years. He's obviously a talented batsman, and they like the look of him. What do you make of him as a one-day player, though?
Well, he's obviously a talented boy. You know, he can bat in many different positions, and he's proved that he's capable of moving into that side. Obviously, losing Jason Roy is a massive loss. But, yeah, so it's only for two games. You know, it'd be a good opportunity for James to come in and see what he can do. You know, and you'd hope that he'd be at the top of the order and he can go and free himself up and play his natural game.
I've already had this argument with someone in the office today about Joe Root opening the batting. My theory is that in the first 10 overs, you know, you don't get many power play overs these days. You want someone who's going to punch the ball through the field on a regular basis, whereas Root these days is, albeit a very good one, more of an accumulator in the one-day game. Would you sort of try and shy England away from giving him the chance to open?
No, not necessarily. I mean, Amla's done it for South Africa for many years. They're similar types of players. I mean, I think what you see with Joe Root at the moment, he's very adaptable and he can bat in different positions and at different times of the innings. So I would have no hesitation in putting him at the top of the order. You've seen it with Ian Bell. I mean, good stroke players, you know, are very successful in one-day cricket. I mean, I think you find that Sri Lanka went through much of their one-day success with people like Sangakkara and Jayawardena, who just didn't, there was no sort of massive hitting to it. They were just good shots. So I think England can still score quickly. And I think if you've got Joe Root back for 50 overs, you're going to find that you're going to be 300, 350 anyway. So I would have no problem with putting Root at the top of the order, but at the same time, they've got to get Vince in. They might as well give him a go up there as well.
What have you made of this World Cup so far? We were thinking it would be, you know, because we're so used to watching England make 350 these days, we were expecting lots of runs and you know, just massive scores everywhere. It's not really played out like that. Do you think that plays into England's hands at all, or is it just gone the way it's gone and that is just a coincidence?
Well, I think first and foremost, the weather's not been great. So pitch preparation has been not as good as it could have been. So I think you're seeing some pitches that have probably offered a little bit more for the seamers, which in itself is not a bad thing because you've got some very good teams and very good bowling attacks. And I think sometimes you just need a bit more of an even contest. And I think the way the one-day cricket was going, it was too heavily favoured in the way of batting teams. And this way, you know, I think you're seeing the bowlers bite back a little bit. And as is always the way with these things, you know, you see a scores going north towards 400 and then the bowlers will find a way and fight back. So I think you've got to credit the bowlers to a certain degree and say that they've done a reasonable job in restricting teams.
And I imagine as a man with, the thousands of first-class wickets, you're probably quite enjoying watching a decent amount of bowling going on as well as just people hitting it a long way.
Absolutely. You know, the game of cricket needs a good contest. You can't just turn up and expect the side to get 400 every time. Otherwise, you're not going to produce any bowlers.
Mm.
So it's important the bowlers do have their say in the tournament. I think you'll find that as the tournament goes on, with the weather as it is, the bowlers, especially the opening bowlers, are going to be playing a massive part. If they can get two or three wickets early in the first 10 overs, it's going to provide a massive boost for the side in restricting them under 300.
Where do you stand on England's bowling attack at the moment? Because you've seen the Archer Wood sort of full artillery set up. We've seen Liam Plunkett, obviously, he's got a little bit of an injury problem at the moment as well. We hope he's going to be fit. Do you think that when you've got Mark Wood and Jofra Archer both fully fit at your disposal, you should go all guns blazing and pick them both?
Yeah, again, depends on the pitch, depends on what's required on the day. You know, if you're playing on a slightly dampish wicket, then yeah, bowlers like Chris Wokes are going to be massively influential in these games. I think Archer's all-round talent has been exceptional. Mark Wood and, to a lesser degree, Plunkett are very much flat wicket bowlers, and they come into their own when you need to hit the wicket hard and get a three-round sort of chest waist height and restrict the batsman to throw their arms at it. So, you know, I think we've got all bases covered, and I'm looking forward to sort of England progressing nicely along, and then there could be some mouth-watering semi-finals.
Just finally, Martin, I think last time we spoke, you were still fairly confident that England would, on balance of probabilities, win the World Cup. Have you been any more or less convinced over the last couple of weeks?
I think I've been more impressed by India, as a side. I think they are, at the moment, the standout side for me. I think England have played as well as they can as yet, but, you know, World Cup is a long tournament and there's a long way to go, but I'd be looking at England still to win, but I think India, you know, are going to be the test for every side playing against them, especially the way they're playing at the moment.
Yeah, probably. Let's try and get them on a sort of cold green seamer in the final. Absolutely. And then we might be all right. Martin, thank you so much for joining us. Always an absolute pleasure to speak to Martin Bicknell, a man with more than 1,000 first-class wickets. Yeah, I don't think you'll find many people have taken more first-class wickets at the Oval either than Martin Bicknell, an absolute Surrey legend and a man who's played international cricket to boot.
Love Sport.
There was no laughing to be had, though, in Leeds at the weekend, not at least at the First Direct Arena, and not at least if your name is Kid Galahad, because he lost a split decision to Josh Warrington, who retained his IBF World Featherweight title. The way I saw it was a deserved retention of the title too. Sometimes when you've got a man who walks into the ring holding a belt, you've got to do a lot to take it off him. You've got to work really hard to make sure the judges go, yep, you know what, we need a new champion here, and he's deserved it. And he, it seems, didn't do enough, but it was a split decision. Reading any reaction on Twitter, you'll see that it really was a split decision right down the middle. Plenty of people going both ways. Let's see what Aki made of it, because he's online. Aki Karim of BritishBoxers.co.uk. You were ringside at Leeds at the weekend. Which way did you call the fight, Aki?
Well, first of all, it was a close fight. It was, you know, it wasn't the prettiest of fights. It was quite frustrating to watch. But in all honesty, I just edged it to Josh Warrington. I thought the right man got the decision. I can see arguments for and against, but that's how I saw it from ringside.
You mentioned that it wasn't the prettiest fight. To the layman, why did that happen? Because, you know, we have a lot of boxing fans in Britain these days, sometimes referred to as casuals in rather sneering tones, but people who wouldn't necessarily watch featherweight boxing of choice. But one of the great things about Josh Warrington is he's pulled people like that into the sport. Maybe break it down for us a little bit. Why did this fight end up being a bit of an ugly one?
It ended up being an ugly one because of Kid Galahad's style, to be honest. His style is, he's from the Ingle gym. They're very good technically. They're very good at slowing the pace of a fight down, for diffusing punches, for diffusing people who want to work at a fast pace. And that's what he did. He sort of killed the going forward motions of Josh Warrington, you know, stopped him from going second and third phase on him. And that's probably why it ended up being a frustrating fight. He also held a lot on the inside. He used a lot of veteran tricks, which is what you've got to do sometimes at high-level boxing. But that's probably why it wasn't the spectacle some people were expecting.
I suppose we were spoilt by the Selby fight and then the Franta fight, both of which are obviously so entertaining for very different reasons. What do you think Warrington will have learnt from this fight? Do you think it will be one of those where he comes out and goes, I know how I can deal with this next time around?
I think so. I mean, you've got to face all different styles when you're the champion, because everybody wants to fight you. This was a mandatory fight. He didn't choose. It's not a voluntary defence. He didn't actually want to necessarily fight this fight. So I actually spoke to somebody on his team this morning, and they mentioned how, well, they've got this out of the way now and they can move on. You know, it's not an ideal style to fight in any sense. But I think you'll find that the other fights he wants out there, the unification fights, they're fighters that come forward a lot more. So we'll see those exciting scraps.
Who is next for Josh Warren? Do you think it'll be a voluntary defence, I suppose? But you think he will go straight to look to unify, or maybe a sort of bridging fight between in the States?
I don't see a bridging fight. I see him going straight for the unification fight. I think we're looking at maybe someone like Oscar Valdez, someone like Leo Santa Cruz. Scott Quigg was ringside as well, which was an interesting one. So I don't know whether they're trying to line up something there. But I see him going for the unification fights. In the post-fight press conference, he was talking about the unification fights. And I think that's actually what he wanted this fight as well. But now he's got that out of the way, I think those are the fights we could see him in next.
Leo Santa Cruz, of course, British boxing fans will remember from those brilliant, brilliant performances against the likes of, well, I mean, his
Frampton.
List is impressive.
Yep.
Do you think that would be a fight Josh Warrington would go into as a big underdog?
No, not really, no. Josh Warrington is an unbeaten world champion. You know, he's not going to go into many fights as a massive underdog. You know, some people are saying they rate him as the best in the division. I don't think he goes in there as an underdog against anyone anymore. It's hard to overlook Josh Warrington and write him off against anyone these days. He's been written off against Selby, written off against Frampton, and he basically walked through those two fighters. So you can't you can't underestimate the man.
Do you think he's the best fighter in the division? You say some people say he's the best fighter in the division. Do you think he's the best fighter in the division?
I think he's in the top three. I'd say Gary Russell Jr. Is a fighter that doesn't get mentioned very often. He's really good. But there's an argument for saying Josh is at the top. I think you've got to look at form as well. And, you know, he's cleaned up domestically. I'd certainly put him in the top three in his division, in the world. But there's an argument for putting him at number one. Yeah, he's the man in form.
In terms of, I mentioned it earlier, I don't think featherweight boxing is necessarily regarded as particularly sexy, especially by, you know, your average sports fan who wants to see big lads taking lumps out of each other. Why do you think Warrington is different? I feel like people are more into Josh Warrington than they previously have been in that division.
Well, he's got a big following from Leeds. I mean, a lot of the Leeds local, you know, the get behind him. He's also bridged that gap between, like, the football and rugby fans who also support him. I also think he does, apart from the last fight, he does actually have a fan-friendly style. He's always pressing the action. I mean, if you look at the Frampton fight, the first two rounds were just unbelievable. I mean, his game plan is literally full-on attack, usually, which is exciting to watch. And he's followed the underdog story. He's had hard fights in his career. He's had to do it the hard way. And I think people are starting to respect him for that, and that possibly why people tune in to watch him.
I just want to ask you about the sort of the top of the undercard from the night as well, i.e. Zelfa Barrett, who, of course, look, I remember him because I had a mate who isn't necessarily a boxing fan, but who spent a long time telling me that Ronnie Clark was going to beat Zelfa Barrett because he couldn't believe that someone would dress like that and not think he was going to win the fight. Now, after that upset, he's obviously now picked up three wins, a Commonwealth super featherweight title as well. What do you make of his prospects in that division as a whole?
Well, I'm probably a little bit biased because, you know, I've known him for a long, long time. Mm. But I've always rated his skills. And the Ronnie Clark fight was a very entertaining fight. I do believe he lost the fight, but it was very close and it was a very entertaining fight. And the knockdown was the difference in the fight on the scorecard. But, you know, in terms of his prospects going forward, he's got all the talent and all the skills. I mean, we saw on Saturday how elusive he is. He was putting together good combinations. He was firing in bursts. He was using the ring well, great on the back foot, and he is one to watch. He really is one to watch, and he's going to be a handful for anyone that he gets in the ring with.
And just finally, Aki, I know you were in Leeds at the weekend, but I also know the Fury camp pretty well, and will have been pleased to see Tyson dispatch Tom Schwartz in two rounds. I think when we spoke last week, you said it was never going to be much different from that. I think you went first round, to be fair, or you might have gone second. I'll have to check my records on that one. How impressive was that display from Tyson, do you think?
Yeah, it was very impressive, wasn't it? I mean, it's one thing saying you're going to knock someone out early, but you actually have to go out and execute it. It wasn't just his, his combination punching. It was how elusive he was. I mean, you know, he moves around like a welterweight. He dances around. He evades shots. He's a crowd pleaser. Everything from the ring entrance to the after, you know, singing afterwards and everything. He's got the full package. And performances like that are gonna catch everyone's attention. And well, I am a bit biased towards Tyson, but I just think he's a one-off.
Yeah, he's. I've never seen anyone of that size move with that sort of grace, that's for sure. Aki, thank you so much for joining us. It's always a real pleasure to have you on the show. Aki Karim there of BritishBoxers.co.uk. He, of course, was ringside as Josh Warrington beat Kid Galahad, a controversial split decision victory for Warrington, but I think on the balance of probabilities, he's probably the right winner on the day. He is now going to take that IBF World Featherweight title somewhere into the States, I would have thought, for a massive unification bout. But he wasn't the only British fighter in action at the weekend. Tyson Fury, of course, as I mentioned, picked up a win. And after that victory, he couldn't resist bringing up Deontay Wilder, saying the result would be obvious if they were to have a rematch.
There was three horses in the heavyweight division, and then there was two. And I already beat him once, so I'll beat him again and again and again. And he ain't going to fight 50% Tyson Fury anymore. He's going to get a fully match fit, back active, back sharp Tyson Fury.
I'm not being funny, but I really, really hate fighters who come out and say, I already beat him, when they didn't. Because that's boxing. When you fight someone, you have judges ringside, you have a referee. And if you don't knock someone out, they are the people who decide if you win. So I don't like it when fighters, as much as Tyson Fury has a lot of likeable things about him, I don't like it when he comes out and says, well, I've already beaten him once, because he didn't, he drew with him. That's just how it is. That's the way boxing works. If you don't knock someone out, you leave it to the judges to decide, and you have to just accept that decision. But that's what happens sometimes. You get fighters who don't like a judge's decision, and they continually bring it up. Tyson took on Tom Schwartz. Now, maybe because of the Andy Ruiz Jr. result, the Anthony Joshua defeat, I was a little bit reticent to completely write off Tom Schwartz. But I think had Joshua not lost to Ruiz Jr. in the way that he did, then I would have been like, well, no, he'll just smash him in a couple of rounds. And so it proved. You can't have an underdog upset every week. And this, let's not make any bones about it. Much as there are a few people saying Tom Schwartz has got a little bit about him, he was a massive underdog in this fight. Against Tyson Fury, a man who got in the ring with Deontay Wilder and didn't lose, the only pro ever to have done that, he was never going to be troubled by Tom Schwartz. He'd never even fought outside of Germany more than twice. He'd never fought outside of Central Europe. He just wasn't a challenger. And this is the point, actually, that Fury wasn't really there to get challenged. He was there to introduce himself to the American market. He, once again, remember, of course, he came out to Living in America, I believe, James Brown. He was covered in stars and stripes. He was wearing one of those funny hats. This was all about Tyson saying, this is what I am about. Hello, America. Hello, Vegas. This is who I am. And that's fine. That's not illegal. That's part of boxing. You've got to have personality because people don't want to just see you fight. They want to see you as a person, as an interesting character. And whatever you think of Tyson Fury, he does have charisma. He does sort of get it. And he is an exciting bloke. But that doesn't mean that we can write off the fact that he's only really had two big fights in his career. Two really big fights. He's had a couple, you know, he's had the likes of Derek Chisora, who he beat, Christian Hammer. You know, the kind of fights that you need to earn world title shots. But since he moved into that elite level, when he beat Vladimir Klitschko in a very ugly but deserved victory, since he moved to that level, he has only had one other big fight, the Deontay Wilder draw. So it's not fair of him, and it's not fair of him to expect us to say, oh yeah, Tyson Fury, one of the greatest of all time. Sure, he looks like he could possibly be a guy who can fight at that elite level for the next 5 years and pick up world titles and be a serious menace. But he is not that yet. He is still a guy who had one great night in Germany and very nearly had one great night in LA. Let's face it, he still had a great night in LA. We had a brilliant fight. It was a massively entertaining bout. And he got up off the canvas in the 12th round when no one thought he could. But he is still not a legend of the sport. And that's kind of what I don't like. As much as it's okay to sit there and say, I think I'm very good, and I think I can really achieve something in the division. You know, what I've sort of respected about Joshua is that he has always said, well, you know, I'm just trying to build a legacy. I don't really have a legacy yet. I'm trying to build a legacy. Fury, I think, believes he already has a legacy. And that doesn't seem right to me. You need a little bit of humility in all walks of life. And I don't know if Tyson has that. Maybe it's part of what he's built up. You know, he's been down right to the bottom with depression. And maybe part of building himself back up is this belief that he is already part of the history books and that he needs and wants to imbue that reputation. But I don't quite enjoy it when he sits in a press conference and says, I've already beaten this bloke, I'm already the biggest horse. What's important now is that Tyson keeps fighting big guys. He should, and he says he will, get into a rematch with Deontay Wilder. Next year, probably. Spring next year, maybe? I'm not sure. Whatever a big weekend in the States is. He should, at some point, fight Anthony Joshua. Maybe he'll fight Wilder a third time, but we'd all love to see that. But he needs to keep fighting those fights. He can't think that he has already made it. But he has made it if he just wanted to be a big character. That already is true. And he certainly made his impression in America on Saturday. Take it away, Tyson.
Every moment spent with you is a moment I treasure forever and ever, and I don't want to close my eyes. I don't want to fall asleep because I love you, babe, and I don't want to miss a thing. God bless America!
Love Sports.
I don't know if many people will recognise his voice if he was interviewed by Sky Sports before the tournament, but they will recognise his voice now and certainly his name. Gary Woodland, the US Open golf champion. I don't know if many people will have had money on him winning. He, of course, beat Brooks Koepka, who came in second, the major machine, who was three strokes back. Justin Rose, Xander Schauffele, John Rahm, Cameron Reavy, all tied for third. Adam Scott was in there as well. Louis Oosthuizen, Rory McIlroy even, not far off either. So it's not as though Woodland came from nowhere and beat a load of nobodies here. This was, of course, a stacked field for the second major of the year, and Gary Woodland came out on top. Dave Clark's on the line, Press Association sports journalist. Dave, I assume you're not going to try and pretend that you backed Gary Woodland for this win, did you?
I did not back Gary Woodland for this win, no.
I did have someone try and tell me earlier that they had money on Gary Woodland, and I basically refused to believe them because they weren't buying the drinks. If I had said the name Gary Woodland to you on Wednesday, what would you have said? What were anyone's expectations of someone like him this week?
Well, you'd have had him down as someone more aiming to make the cut than get into contention. Don't get me wrong, he's a good player. He's won a few PGA Tour titles, but he's renowned as a big hitter who's short game sometimes goes a bit awry, which isn't normally the key to success in major championships, and definitely not at Pebble Beach at a US Open.
Are we expecting this sort of 35-year-old, slightly dad body looking bloke from Kansas to be a major force now? Is this some sort of coming of age, or one of those guys who might be a pub quiz answer in a few years to come?
I think probably the latter. I wouldn't rule him out. Like I said, he's been a top 50 in the world player. He's not completely out the blue like one or two have been over the years, like Y.E. Yang or Todd Hamilton. But it would be a surprise if he won another major, although you never know. If he got the right course set up, a long course, soft conditions, he's proved this week that he's got the right temperament to do it, so why not?
Pebble Beach is, of course, one of the most iconic golf courses probably in the world outside of Augusta and the old course. How do you think it played? You mentioned that it's not supposed to be a course that should have suited him.
No, it played easy. I don't think it's anyone's fault that it played easy. The one thing that nobody can control is the weather, and it was soft because it rained and there was no wind, which when you're that close to the Pacific Ocean, we've seen in previous majors at Pebble Beach, the winds caused havoc for the players involved, and it just wasn't there this week, and it made it slightly easier, I think, than tournament organisers would have liked, but I'm not sure there's a lot they could have done to counteract that.
I have to say, going to bed on Saturday night, waking up Sunday morning, I thought Justin Rose looked like he should be favourite to go out and win it on Sunday. What happened? Shot 74 and fell away.
Yeah, he birdied the first, started really well, and then it just started to chip away a little bit. I think there was probably a combination of things. One, he wasn't swinging that well all week. He sort of battled into position and did well to stay there as long as he did. I think the second thing that happened was that Woodland started so well and Brooks Koepka came out absolutely flying. And maybe that forced Rose to be a little more aggressive than he'd have liked and led to him dropping a few shots, sort of chasing the two leaders.
You mentioned Brooks Koepka there, and he's obviously a guy that divides opinion. Look, his record at majors is unbelievable. Perhaps the only unbelievable thing this week was that he actually didn't win the whole thing, and yet he was close. Do you hate him as much as everyone else does? I guess that's what I'm trying to say.
No, I don't. I think he's sometimes come across as having a bit of a few chips on his shoulders, and he's got big enough shoulders to get quite a lot of chips on, hasn't he? He's genuinely quite a nice guy, and he's quite interesting. For years, we gave the Americans a load of stick for just coming through the PGA Tour and never leaving their home country, and they didn't even want to come over the week before the Open to play the Scottish Open and get used to the conditions. Brooks Koepka completely changed the game on that front. He came over to Europe, he played the Challenge Tour, he travelled all around the world, graduated to the European Tour, earned his dues there, won tournaments. He's really popular amongst the European Tour players, and then once he'd won on the European Tour, went back to America and established himself as this regular major winner. And, you know, for years we were crying out for someone who'd be like that from across the pond. And he's done it. And I think maybe he's come across a bit unfavourably, but he has a point. He plays much better golf over the last few years than Tiger and Rory. So why isn't he talked about more often?
You mentioned Tiger and Rory there. McIlroy 5-under for the tournament, Woods 2-under for the tournament. McIlroy unable to get this monkey off his back now of not having won a major in so long. Was there some good form to be seen from Rory? Obviously with the Open not far away now.
Yeah, Rory McIlroy played some fantastic golf, and almost every week Rory McIlroy played some fantastic golf, but unfortunately there's the same problem that keeps holding him back, and that is his course management. Again yesterday, went out, made a couple of early birdies, nearly had an eagle at one hole where he almost chipped in. But there's so many dropped shots, and it's just poor club selection. He tries to be far too aggressive. And I think a lot of us in the media feel like it might be a problem with his caddies that he's had, and that he's got his sort of his best friend on the bag.
I was going to ask you who's on the bag now, because didn't he have his best man on the bag?
Yeah, a guy called Harry Diamond. And I think you can't tell someone who's been successful as Rory McIlroy this is what you need to change, but I think there are a lot of people who feel like that is the area he needs to change. And that actually someone, you look at successful partnerships, you look at Tiger Woods with Steve Williams, he would stand up for Tiger to the crowd and things, and was quite an unpopular guy, you know, amongst spectators and so on, but also would stand up to Tiger and tell him when he thought he was wrong. And that's what Rory needs, I think, out on the course. Someone just to rein him in a little bit when he gets a little bit too aggressive and tries to take on a little bit too much.
Well, he's probably going to need a little bit of reining in when the Open Championship does come round, because I think it'll be quite an emotional occasion for him. Obviously, it's at Royal Port Rush in County Antrim. How do you think he's shaping up ahead of that? As you say, there's some good form in there. Should we have any higher expectations for Rory than usual this year, or sort of even par, if you like?
Yeah, I think he's one of the leading contenders, as he has been for a number of years now. I think the question mark I'd have over Rory McIlroy, he's won one Irish Open, but his record in general playing on his homeland isn't brilliant. So it's not like he's regularly gone back there and shown what a great player he is. And I think he's spoken himself, he was a tournament host for the Irish Open for a few years, and he spoke about how that pressure was sometimes a bit too much for him. If he can go, not under the radar so much, but maybe if a few eyes are looking elsewhere, looking at people like Brooks Koepka and Tiger, and that can take a little bit of the attention off him, there's no reason why he can't win it.
Well, let's hope they put him in a kind pairing then with two blokes we've never heard of, like someone called Gary Woodland. Anyway, Dave, thank you so much for coming on. Always a pleasure to have you here. Dave Clark, Press Association sports journalist there. Rory McIlroy, remember, taking the Open Championship to Northern Ireland. I mean, there will be pressure on him there. And of course, there should be. But he is a guy now who should be able to handle it. That's the level of golf we expect from Rory McIlroy. He needs to stand up and be counted at the Open in County Antrim in July. Otherwise, we're going to start to question how talented he really is.
Love Sport.
Game of the weekend, of course, was India versus Pakistan. India came through, but Pakistan captain Sarfraz Ahmed was speaking after his side's defeat, and he's still confident they can make it through the last four.
Definitely it's tougher, but we have to back ourselves. We have four matches, so we'll try our level best to all four the matches win. So, inshallah, we will bounce back.
Bounce back indeed. Pakistan will need to. Obviously, hugely disappointing to lose to bitter rivals India up in Manchester in front of a raucous crowd. Apparently, there are 250,000 applications for tickets for that game. I'm not surprised, and I'm a little surprised it's not more, actually, quite frankly. There were so many brilliant moments, But Coley walks. Probably words that due fireworks and celebratory gunfire in Pakistan and around the world, frankly, because there will have been millions, close to a billion people watching this game. Virat Kohli walked back to the pavilion for 77. He left the crease voluntarily. 14 balls left in the innings and he walked away. Obviously, there were only two overs and a bit left, but it nevertheless felt like a really big moment. You know, obviously, because it's Mohammad Amir, Pakistan's star bowler, probably their best bowler, in fact definitely their best bowler this World Cup anyway, getting rid of the India captain, stopping him from doing a bit more damage at the end of the innings, and the fact that he walked. You know, this is the India captain walking against Pakistan. It was, you would think, the ultimate show of sportsmanship, and here, at the highest level, in a grudge match. But actually, there was more amazement to be had. Because when you looked at the replays, Kohli hadn't even hit it. He'd missed it. And he'd walked. I mean, it beggars belief. A man like Virat Kohli, probably the most competitive cricketer I can think of, walking. And he hadn't even hit it. I mean, there's mistakes and then there's failing to realise that actually you've missed the ball when you thought you had hit it. My theory, and it's a rough one, and it is just a theory, is that Kohli's starting to believe his own hype. You know, he got, and it annoyed me. I tell you, opinion is divided. It annoyed me when he went over to the India fans and gestured them to stop booing Steve Smith and Dave Warner and instead applaud them. But a lot of people gave him a lot of credit for that. Another great show of sportsmanship. You know, what a guy. Gave him, you know, huge plaudits. And I think that, you know, the guy's already got an ego. Clearly already got an ego. You have to. He's the best cricketer in the world. But he, I think, is starting to believe his own sort of legend. Because in the age of DRS, walking in an international cricket match, it just isn't the same. Because the reason you would walk, you know, and in the pre-TV era, pre-DRS era, the reason you would walk is to uphold this sort of general sense of justice in the game. You know, I hit that, so I actually shouldn't wait for the umpire to make a decision. I should just go and make sure that, you know, the laws of the game are properly applied, because the umpire might not notice that I hit it. So I'll walk. And fine, and in amateur cricket, I think more people should walk. I'm a walker, you know, I play cricket every Saturday, and I am a walker, sort of part of my identity as a cricketer, I suppose. I've just always done it. I don't even really have a moral justification for doing it. I just do it. If I nick it, I go. And that's just the way that I do it. I don't want to win any plaudits for that, nor should Virat Kohli. But I think, you know, that walk, if he thought about it, he might think, actually, I don't want to walk in this situation. But he was so carried away with his own legend. And, you know, he ended up basically disadvantaging the team for his own personal glorification. You know, it's fine because India won, but it's not a great attitude. Not a great mindset for a captain, is it? To want to glorify himself beyond what's going on with the team. And frankly, the team need him because there's an injury concern as well. Bowler Bhuvaneshwar Kumar, he's now a doubt for the upcoming games. Let's hear what Kohli himself said about that injury.
We're going to give it some time. Hopefully, he'll be ready in a couple of games, if not max by three games from now. He's going to be a very important factor for us, so hopefully he can recover well in time.
He will be a very important part of that India team, especially if the weather continues to get worse, because he's someone who's very effective in English wet and wild conditions. And of course, we've seen plenty of rain this summer, unfortunately, in the World Cup. We were hoping it wouldn't be one of those summers. Hoping for a rerun of last year, I suppose, but it wasn't to be. So I've come up with some solutions to rain-affected games in the Cricket World Cup. I'm willing to offer the ECB, if any of you are listening, or maybe I'll have to put a formal pitch together, willing to offer my consultative services at a very reasonable rate, and I wouldn't be the first. By the way, a fascinating report earlier this month from Martin Ziegler in The Times pointed out that the ECB had met representatives of Google X, you know, that very experimental wing of the global giant, to deal with the rain problem at the Cricket World Cup. And they were talking about various different solutions. Now, the meeting was confidential. The ECB admitted that the meeting took place, but it was confidential. So, of course, some journalists reported what had been talked about, just to fill in the gaps. And it was revealed that the ECB had basically talked about cloud seeding, for starters, which essentially involves injecting clouds with a sort of sodium compound, which triggers rain. That sounds like the opposite one. So what you do is you do that, and the idea being the clouds have rained themselves out by the time they get to the venue. The Chinese did it for the Olympics in 2008. But that would have cost them about £800,000 a game. And even for the ECB, that seemed a little steep. So they also looked at a solution. It's actually born out of Google's efforts to bring Wi-Fi to rural Africa involving hot air balloons. And what the ECB wanted to do, or thought they could do, a solution that was supposedly put to them, was to put a very fine mesh suspended from the floodlights above the whole ground, and then a hot air balloon to hold it all up. It kind of makes quite a lot of sense, actually. I quite like it. It doesn't sound cheap. It doesn't sound very safe. It sounds very untested. But fine, why not? And actually, I'm all in favour of innovation in cricket. And when it comes to rain, I often wonder, why do we have to obsess about, you know, not playing cricket in the rain? Every other sport gets played in the rain, or the snow, or the wind. Let's just get on with it. So why not adapt the conditions? You know, plenty of amateur football, and more every year, is played on artificial surfaces. It's good for the game because you play a better standard of football. It's good for kids' development because they're not hampered by terrible pitches. And it's good for venues because they can get more games on. You know, I used to play so much football on grass, and that's between like November and February, you just don't play any games, just all get rained off. So why not look for that in cricket? Why not have an artificial outfield that can withstand the rain, that doesn't get ruined by a week's rain? Why not have that? You know, an artificial fake grass instead of having a big expansive outfield. And why not have some research into creating an artificial pitch that behaves a bit more like grass? In Australia, most amateur cricket is played on artificial pitches, so why not extend that into the professional game and say, yeah, we'll play on this track, and if not, if it rains on the day, we'll play on this one. Get a more waterproof ball. Make bats more waterproof. Make the whole game more accessible to being played in more weather conditions. Why not? Cricket has to try and survive in all conditions, so why not try and make it more sustainable in the rain? I'm not having people who say, let's just not have the World Cup. In England, you get rain all over the world. So let's try and make cricket a better sport by adapting it to the modern world and modern life. You can't just pick and choose when it's raining and when it's not.
Love sport.
And I'm starting to think that maybe it's time I get a new challenge, eh, Ben? Because I'm a bit sick of the challenge of working with you. And Frank, right, no, okay, I'm staying. Somehow, not getting sacked is a positive in this particular situation. Let's hear a little bit of why we're talking about Paul Pogba quite so much.
Well, after this season, and after everything that happened this season, you know, with my season, for me, it was my best season as well. I think for me, it could be... Can be a good time to have a new challenge somewhere else. I'm thinking of this, to have a new challenge somewhere else. Yeah.
I find it pretty rich, if I'm honest, pretty hollow from Paul Pogba to come out and say he's ready for a new challenge. As Oliver Kay said in his Times column this morning, Pogba had always seemed to regard Old Trafford as a stage rather than a place to challenge himself week in, week out. I don't think Paul Pogba likes a challenge. I don't think he wants it. And I think Ollie Kay hit the nail right on the head there. Because when Paul Pogba came back to Old Trafford, you know, it was for a world record fee of £89.3 million. He was the prodigal son returning to the club where he'd been turfed out just 4 years previous. He should have come back wanting to prove something. Wanting to say, Fergie, you should never have let me go. Wanting to say to the fans, I'm not the guy who thought I was too big for his boots. I'm the guy who's going to show them I'm worth £89 million. Instead, Pogba thought he'd made it. And at the age of 23, he thought, right, I'm going to cash in here. I've got loads of Twitter followers. I'm massive on Instagram. I've got a brilliant personal brand. I'm going to make so much money out of piggybacking onto Manchester United. And let's face it, that's part of the reason Manchester United signed him. For the same reasons. They thought, yep, we're a massive club, we've made it, we're at the top of the game, now let's cash in on our commercial ventures and make sure that Paul Pogba can help advance the club on a worldwide basis. And that's fine, if all you care about are the commercial bottom lines. But those lines are inextricably linked to the football. And the problem really is that when it came to the football, Pogba didn't want to do the hard yards. He didn't want to do the hard work. And it's coincided, and you can say this is chicken and egg, or you can say that the two are properly linked and one has caused the other. But they coincided with the greatest period of decline at United since the mid-1970s, when they were relegated to the second tier of English football. No one has really, therefore, been able to deal with Pogba. No one has been able to sit him down and say, you know what, mate, this is actually not allowed. This is not okay. To treat people the way you treat people, to act the way you act, that's not all right. Like a sort of mischievous and troubled child, what he needed was consistency. Consistency and discipline. Because that's what children need. If you give them inconsistency and no real discipline or changing levels of discipline, they can't cope. There's nothing they can do. They're going to act out because they don't know what sort of level of discipline they've got above them. Now, he's basically exploited that and found these pockets of weakness where his ego and his laziness, it would appear, his insolence at least, could thrive. So, look, his new challenge statement, it's something we've heard before from a lot of players, and actually twice over the last month or so, quite prominently. So, first Christian Eriksen, and now Paul Pogba. But there is a difference. Actually, there are loads of differences between Eriksen and Paul Pogba. For a start, there are their production levels. Right, since Pogba came back into the Premier League, he scored 24 goals. In the same time, Eriksen has scored 26. Pogba's produced 23 assists, and in that same period, Eriksen's produced 37. Now, you would not say that goal scoring is a massive part of Christian Eriksen's game. You would say that assists are. And actually, you would also say that Christian Eriksen offers a lot more than just goals and assists. You can't say the same about Paul Pogba. His game is centred around creating and scoring goals. And football isn't just a raw numbers game, but for Pogba, it more often than not is. Especially when he does a little other work as he does. It should also be, his game should also be, and should be the optimal word here, about stepping up for his team, about dragging them out of trouble, about wanting to make sure they're not a Europa League club anymore, that they are a Champions League club. He shouldn't be someone who gets offered to City because United are sick of having to deal with him. He shouldn't be someone even open to that. But he should be the man. He thinks he's the man, but he's not. He's displayed none of those qualities. And when you compare it to Eriksen, whose production is better, who said the same thing about wanting a new challenge, it just rings so hollow. Eriksen's had so many better offers than Tottenham over the years he's been there, and he's turned them down. He's had so many deals offered to him, and he's turned them down. He makes just £3.5 million a year, Christian Eriksen. That's his annual salary. Now, to me and Ben, well, at least to Ben, that sounds like a fortune. But actually, when you compare it to the rest of the market, when you look at it, Eden Hazard's making 20 million quid a year. Paul Pogba's making 15. Eriksen looks like a pauper. And when he says he thinks it might be time for a new challenge, it's because, you know what? He came to a club that finished sixth in his first season there. And they got knocked out of the Europa League in the last 16 by Benfica. You take that to where he's got them now. Four consecutive top four finishes and therefore qualification for the Champions League. And a Champions League final. Touching distance even of a Premier League title, by the way. So when he says new challenge, it's because he's actually challenged himself. And he's pushed himself and he's pushed the club maybe as far as he thinks they can go. Just a conversation for another day. But Eriksen should say to Pogba, come on, mate, do you really think you've challenged yourself? But are we being too harsh on Paul Pogba here? Are we being too harsh on a bloke who's been led astray by his agent, by Mino Raiola, the man who loves picking up a youngster looking for a father figure and guiding them through life while taking 10 and more percent of their earnings? Certainly, according to the reporting of Sam Luckhurst, who's the chief Manchester United writer for the Manchester Evening News, and why should I question him, it would suggest it is a Mino Raiola problem. He tweeted yesterday, when Mino Raiola advised Paul Pogba to rejoin United in 2016, it was on the proviso that he would try to get him to Spain after 3 years. MUFC have been adamant they won't sell Pogba. He's got 2 years left on his contract and the option of a 1 year rests with United. So is it any surprise that Paul Pogba's found himself as a pawn in this battle when you've got two such massive bodies, and I mean that literally in Mineirola's case, the man who loves a velvet tracksuit but not going to the gym, is there any surprise that Pogba has found himself torn between these two parties? Maybe a stronger character would have said, no, you know what, my football is what earns me the money and that's what I need to focus on. But I don't think Paul Pogba thinks of himself as a footballer anymore. It's okay to be a footballer first and a few other things second, but I don't think he thinks that. I think he thinks he is a personality figure, a celebrity, a marketing figure first. I think he's a footballer. He thinks he's a footballer second. And you know what? The salient point to all of that is, if you're a United fan, you must think that United would be far, far better off without him. Far, far better off without a summer of sweating blood to keep Paul Pogba at the club. If they do keep him, it'll be the latest folly. It won't be their first, it probably won't be their last, and the list is getting ever longer.
Love Sport.
Before Chelsea just sort of wantonly get pulled into the trap, and it is a bit of a trap, just to say, let's give one of our club legends the chance to be manager. Because he's still relatively green, you know, in this particular job, in this line of work. He's still really just an ex-player. You know, he's obviously got a year of management and he knows a lot about football in general. No doubt about that. But it could still be a difficult step up for him to make. But is it right for Chelsea to be managed by him? You know, there's kind of a checklist, almost a list of questions that the Chelsea board should be asking themselves now that Sarri is gone. First of all, what sort of manager do we want to replace him? Do we want to, you know, because they've made a success out of working with short-term managers, with guys for a year or 2 years or occasionally longer. That's kind of something that has become part of the Chelsea way. You know, you talk a lot about the West Ham way, the Manchester United way, the Chelsea way. Get sacked after a year and a half and get paid off. Do they want to keep doing that? Because it's an expensive endeavour, to say the least. Or do they want to pick someone and go, right, I'll give you a 3-year or 4-year contract. Here's our 5-year plan. You're a big part of that. Let's see what we can do. Because to me, that's a logical way of adopting. If it doesn't work, it doesn't work. But that seems like the lower risk option. Could they try and pick someone who, right, we like what you're doing. We like your style. Because, by the way, Maurizio Sarri's playing style was completely different from everything they'd done before. So why wouldn't they have stuck with him? You know, why would they have not said to Juve, nope, you need to give us 20 million. Look, Maurizio, you know, we like you. But realistically, and this is kind of part of their second question, Chelsea need to stop upsetting managers, don't they? Because they're in a situation where not many top managers want the Chelsea job. Sarri got booed by the fans after he lost about one game. He was never under really appreciated for what he was doing, which is trying to build a brand new system despite having had almost no pre-season and not a lot of backing from the board. He left for a better life. You know, remember, these managers are just humans as well. Do they still want to come to Chelsea? And all the hassle that comes with that, all the lack of control over transfers. If they can't attract top managers anymore, they need to change their tune so that people will want to work there again. And, you know, I mentioned transfers. That's question three. How do they deal with this transfer ban? We don't know exactly what this transfer ban is going to look like at the moment, because it could still be that Chelsea end up getting it deferred. That's something that Spanish clubs have been given a lot of opportunities to do. Doesn't seem very likely, I admit, but they could still find themselves having an active transfer window. But if they don't, what do? Do they stick with the players they've got and go, you know what, we're going to make this work? Or do they, and this seems like the logical thing, I know a lot of them want them to do this, do they take the young players and say, right, Tammy Abraham, Mason Mount, you're going to come out and you're going to be Chelsea stars now. It's time for you to step up from the loan system. They've got a top, top youth academy, Chelsea. They've produced a lot of players. Do they not need to look at their first team now and say, actually, we'd quite like you to come and do the job there? I don't know. Question four, what should the structure of the club look like? You know, when you're hiring a manager, you need to think about what structure you're going to move him into and whether you need to change that structure from the previous guy. Have they got a director of football or not? Marina Gradovskaya, what is your job? Does the manager have a big say in transfers or not? Do they want to play a particular style? Do they want to continue with Sarri ball even without Sarri? Do they want to play defensive football? Do they just want to be pragmatic and win trophies? Is that the answer? They don't seem to have an overall philosophy at the moment. And I don't always like the word philosophy in football, but what it means is they haven't got a strategy, a cohesive, this is what we're working towards. And if you haven't got that running through a company, in football or otherwise, there's very little you can do about that. There's very little you can achieve other than a bit of short-termism and mumbling through by spending too much money. So finally, what is their future going to look like? Will the owner still be there? What are the plans for the new stadium? How exactly is this transfer ban going to work? All of these questions come down to proper planning. And there isn't much evidence. And if you were a manager looking at the Chelsea job, would you want that job when you consider how unclear the future is going to be? Now, I just don't understand it. Now, you do have to give people a chance, but isn't it too soon? Surely it's too soon for Lampard to go in after 1 year of management experience. Because there's so many questions. I mentioned those five questions, there are many more. Can Lampard come in and be the man to answer them? Can he be the man to come in and look at the whole structure of the club and say, look, actually, I don't just want to be the manager here. I want to change this. I want a director of football. I want to revamp the academy system. I want to change the way decisions are made at every level. Is it right for a manager who in the end is middle management, being the manager is not the boss of the football club anymore, a lot of people over your head, is it right for someone like him in that role to do that? Does he have the relevant experience to do that? I think what's clear is Chelsea's situation, Chelsea's structure is not right at the moment because they keep cycling through managers. They can't get it right. And now they don't even have the excuse of that much success. Albeit Sarri won the Europa League and third place in the Premier League, that was an improvement on what had gone before. And they might find themselves slipping from those standards next year. So Chelsea need to recognise the problems before they start to out. Because if they drop out of the top four again, if they drop out, heaven forfend, the top six, then it's much harder to fix. You need to fix the problems before they take hold. Because once you get the infection through the whole club, then you start to look like Manchester United.
This is Love Sport.
You've been listening to a podcast edition of The James Gray Show. Remember to leave us a rating and a review, but only nice ones. I don't take criticism well.